Congratulations. And today, Fernando is going to tell us some kind of detailed, concrete results about a relation or lack thereof between exact non-perturbative solutions of 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity coupled with matter, so there are infinitely many degrees of freedom, and the perturbative treatment, the standard kind of perturbative treatment. So Fernando is in Madrid. Please, Fernando, you can start.
Okay, hello everybody. The title of the talk is slightly different from the one that I sent, but we'll talk about the same thing. So this is perturbative and non-perturbative treatments of 2 plus 1 gravity coupled to scalars. So I will give a short introduction about Einstein-Rosen waves, and then I will discuss some issues about the relationship between perturbative and non-perturbative aspects of the quantization of these Einstein-Rosen waves. So please, next slide. So one space-like Killing vector reductions of gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions can be interpreted as theories of 2 plus gravity coupled to massless scalar matter. If we require the existence of another space-like Killing field, these models simplify further, and we have two main cases. The non-polarized case, in this case, the Killings are not hypersurface orthogonal, and the model is equivalent to two sigma models in 1 plus 1 dimensions with two massless coupled scalar fields. These can be treated perturbatively, and this has been mostly looked at by Niedermayer. I will not talk much about this, though, even though I may say something at the end of the talk. And then there is the polarized case. In this case, both Killings are hypersurface orthogonal. This, in particular, implies that the Killing vector fields are themselves orthogonal. And the most important example in this polarized case is the one provided by Einstein-Rosen waves, which are equivalent to axisymmetric 2 plus 1 gravity coupled to a massless scalar field in a fixed auxiliary Minkowskian background. Now, due to this, the model can be exactly quantized with a Fox space quantization. This was done some time ago by Ashtekar, Pierre, Madhavan, Balarayan. So next slide. Now, as you can see, there is an interesting relationship between symmetry reductions of 3 plus 1 gravity on one hand and lower dimensional theories of gravity coupled to massless matter fields. So the purpose of the talk is to discuss some issues related to the perturbative and non-perturbative treatments of quantum gravity from the detailed study of these quantized Einstein-Rosen waves. Of course, the question that one has in mind, that I have written here in a box, is the following. Does the non-renormalizability of general relativity in the usual perturbative formulation mean that it cannot be consistently quantized? And I will try to give at least a partial answer to this question by studying these type of models. I will mostly concentrate on two different issues. One has to do two inequivalent quantizations that you find when you study perturbations around Minkowski and compare the result with the full non-perturbative Fock quantization of the system. And another issue that I will discuss in some detail is, in the case of quantized Einstein-Rosen waves, how you would get perturbative expansions in the effective gravitational constant, that is how the coupling constant of the system. So I will give some facts, I will pose some questions, and try to give answers to those, and I will be also making some comments. So, of course, feel free to interrupt me whenever you want to ask something, but I will follow more or less the same procedure that Abai followed in the first talk, and I will stop at some points to just have some discussion in case you have some comments, okay? I will tell you when I stop. So in slide number 4, I will review quickly some things about linearly polarized cylindrical gravitational waves, Einstein-Rosen waves. Now, some symmetry reductions of general relativity can be exactly quantized despite having local degrees of freedom and some different variants. So these are really very interesting models to try to understand what happens with the quantization of different variant theories with local degrees of freedom. Now, in the case of Einstein-Rosen waves, The dynamics of the system, when physical boundary conditions for the fields are imposed, is given by the following Hamiltonian. This was found by Abai and Balaban some years ago. Now, the Hamiltonian is a function of the free Hamiltonian corresponding to a scalar field, a massless axisymmetric scalar field evolving in a 2+1 dimensional Minkowskian background. So I have written both the physical Hamiltonian that we will call H and this H0 Hamiltonian, which is this free Hamiltonian. Okay? I'm using units for which C and H were taken equal to 1. G3 is the gravitational constant for unit length in the direction of the symmetry axis. And this capital G is H bar times G3, which in these units has is a length. It's a characteristic length of the system that will appear throughout in all the expressions, and it plays a role more or less analogous to the Planck length. Okay. So the quantization of the system, please go to the next slide, can be made in a focus space. Now, the local degrees of freedom in these Einstein-Rosen waves, there is 1 degree of freedom per space point, can be represented in terms of a scalar field that I'm calling phi g, and the quantum field can be written in terms of creation and annihilation operators, A and A dagger, that satisfy the usual commutation relations. And I mean, the expression just involves some zero Bessel function. Now, in terms of this field, the quantum Hamiltonian, after normal ordering the exponent because otherwise it is trivial if you have an infinite constant in the exponent, is given by that expression, 1 over 4g, 1 minus the exponential of the free Hamiltonian. There is a k missing in that expression and in the following one. And of course, once you have this Hamiltonian, which is time independent, it is possible to write the unitary evolution operator immediately, just by exponentiating, okay? So we have an exact unitary evolution operator for this system. So if you go to the next slide, there are some comments to be made here. The first is that, in a sense, this is it as far as the quantization is concerned. I mean, this is a completely full non-perturbative quantization in a Fock space. And if we have that, and in particular if we have the unitary evolution operator, we can compute exactly the evolution of any Fock state that we wish. Okay? And in particular, we can get the S matrix because it can be obtained just as a limit of this unitary evolution operator. And here I'm thinking of the X matrix in the usual particle physics way, I mean, in which you take some particles very far in the past, you evolve those states in the very far future, and compare what you get. Okay? So I will stop here for a moment in case there is any comment or any question.
Yeah, maybe Fernando, you can say where the non-triviality is, because this is all kind of free field, and then somehow the non-triviality has to do with when you try to express physical metrics and so on.
Well, the non-triviality of the system has to do with on one hand, it reflects on the fact that the Hamiltonian is a non-linear function of a free Hamiltonian. Okay. And why that is because you are when you are imposing boundary conditions, the time that you are, the physical time of the system is given by an asymptotic Killing field at infinity. Okay, so that reflects on the fact that the Hamiltonian there is not just the simple free Hamiltonian, but this non-linear function, this which is by the way bounded both below and above. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay. Are there any other comments or questions? Okay. Then I will go ahead. So let's go to the next transparency number 7. So something that should be discussed with a little bit of care is what do we mean by perturbative? Okay. So, in the usual perturbative approach to quantum gravity, and I'm thinking here about the classical papers of Thorsten Bellman where they proved that, where they looked at the one loop renormalizability of the Einstein-Hilbert action, as one of Alcioni's papers and many others. In those papers, the main goal was to obtain contour terms for the Einstein-Hilbert action to find out if the theory was normalizable. Okay? Of course, if one would have found that the theory was normalizable, in a further step, one would have tried to answer physical questions. Yes, computers, metrics, elements, of course, coupled matter, and see what one would get. Okay. Now, a clever way to do this, to compute contour terms in the usual formulation of gravity, is imported from the perturbative treatment of Jan Mills. And the idea is to use the so-called background field method. Now, in the Gamil case, what you do is you split the field as a sum of a background field plus some quantum perturbation. You write the action in tensor time. Of course, as the Gamil action is polynomial, you end up having a quartic polynomial, even if you do this split of the field as a background plus a quantum perturbation. And then you use that to compute contour terms. And it's convenient to do that because computations are much simpler than in the case where you work just with the field as it is in the action. Okay. Now, for gravity, you can try something similar. And what you would do is just splitting the metric into pieces, one fixed metric, which is usually taken as non-singular background metric. I will call that G0. And a quantum fluctuation, HAB, okay, which, for example, appears in the path interval measure. I mean, in a sense, this is just a change of variables in the functional interval. So what we see here is that this background metric plays two roles. On one hand, is the background field in terms of which these covariant contour terms will be built, but it is also a convenient extra structure that is useful to define propagators, introduce some kind of background causality in the system in order to do quantum field theory. Okay? Now, the next slide, I make some comments. Of course, you could work with a background Minkowski metric, but then the problem is that you cannot write the contour terms in terms of them because these contour terms will involve a curvature, and of course this is zero for the Minkowski metric eta. Of course, you can try to do the computations in a different way, just not using this background field method, and of course you would finally get the contour terms, but you really have to collect the different powers of H to find out what these covariant contour terms are. Now, in any case, the Lagrangian density is substituted by an infinite series that involves arbitrary powers of H. This series defines the vertices that you need to construct Feynman diagrams. And of course, you need Feynman diagrams because you must use them to write down the Green's functions as power series in the coupling constant, that in this case would be the gravitational constant Gn. So there are two meanings of the word perturbative here. The first one, it refers to this expansion, G as D equal to J0 plus HAB, that you really need to introduce in order to define propagators and have vertices. The vertices, and it is interesting to notice that the gravitational constant will appear in the vertices because if you do the usual type of redefinition that you also do in your Mills, then it will appear in front of the H, okay? You have the gravitational constant appearing there. And then there is another sense of perturbative, which is the one referring to expansions of physical quantities, in particular Green's functions, the S matrix, as powers of Gn. Now, it is interesting to point out that both points of view are relevant to the quantization of Einstein-Rosen waves. Now, I will stop again here to see if there are comments or questions. If not, I will go on. So let's discuss about the first meaning. What I will be talking about here appears in this paper written with Guillermo and Eduardo. And now the question that we address in this paper is the following. What is the relationship between the exact Fock quantization of Einstein-Rosen waves and the one that you will obtain by describing the system as a perturbation of Minkowski? Now, the usual way to write the metric for Einstein-Rosen waves, which is, in fact, the starting point for the usual treatments and the Fock, the non-perturbative Fock quantization of the system, is this metric that I am writing here. Now, you can introduce new fields, as I am doing there, these bar fields, M bar, NR bar, gamma bar, psi bar, and rho bar, defined in this way here. And the reason why you want to do that is because, in terms of M, the metric that you can see in the next slide has the following form. It's something that is exactly Minkowski when these fields vanish, okay? Now, the idea is, well, let's quantize the system using both sets of fields. Of course, with the original set of fields, you find the usual Asher-Carpieri quantization, for instance, Rosen waves. And what we are going to do now is try to see what the quantization in terms of these fields is, okay? So you will start by finding the reduced Hamiltonian. In fact, you can compare the reduced Hamiltonians in both formulations after the suitable gate fixing, which in fact is the same one, just written in terms of the new set of variables. And I remind you that the usual gate fixing that you use in the Asher-Carpieri quantization is small r equal to capital R. Remember that small r is a function of the coordinates capital R and t. And then p gamma equal to zero, where p gamma is the momentum canonically conjugate to this gamma field that appears in the metric. Okay? There is a canonical transformation that relates both sets of variables. Okay? Now, if one considers the linearization of the Einstein-Rosen model around Minkowski, saying by keeping only the quadratic terms in the bar fields in the reduced Hamiltonian, you get the reduced Hamiltonian for the model in linearized gravity. Okay? And this turns out to be exactly the Hamiltonian for a massless scalar field with rotational symmetry in a 2 plus 1 dimensional background. So next slide. I would like to make a comment on gauge fixing, and the comment is the following. The usual gauge fixing that is used in the Asher-Carpieri formulation can be thought of as a generalization of the usual de Bonder gauge, okay? There is a semicolon missing in the H-bar. Now, the perturbative quantization of the model is done in this new fake space, Fock space, that I have introduced by using these bar fields. And this Fock space is the one provided by the free theory that corresponds to the linearization of the Einstein-Rosen model. Of course, after you have to incorporate somehow the interactions provided by the higher order terms in the action. And of course, at some point, you'll have to use some approximation scheme to compute physical objects. Now, the question is the following. How are both Fock spaces, in particular the vacua, for both quantizations related? I mean, is there any relationship between the non-perturbative vacuum that appears in the Asher-Carpieri quantization of the system and the linear and the vacuum of the linearized model? Is there any quantization between them? Now, because we have a canonical transformation between both formulations, we know how to write objects in one formulation in terms of objects defined in the other. So, in particular, we can write down the creation and annihilation variables of one of the approaches in terms of the ones for the other, because, as I say here, we know how both formulations are related. Now, these formulas are quite complicated, but they have an important feature, which is the following. The Asher-Carpieri creation and annihilation variables appear multiplied by the square root of g in this formula. So it is natural to consider expansions, power series expansions, in terms of this square root of g. Now, the main result of this paper that I was mentioning before is the following. Please go to the next transparency. If one tries to write the perturbative vacuum as a power series involving the vacuum in the Ashton-Carpieri formulation and M particle states in this Ashton-Carpieri formulation, then you see that this perturbative vacuum is non-normalized. It's not normalizable. Okay, it cannot be written as a linear combination of these other objects. Now we take this as a very strong indication that both quantizations are not equivalent. So from here, I have written here a warning and morale, which is that depending on the choice of variables that one uses to quantize the model, and certainly when one uses perturbative approaches in this first sense that I was mentioning at the beginning, one may end up with non-equivalent quantizations. So one must be very careful with it. So I will stop here again to see if there are any comments or questions.
Okay, maybe you can clarify a few things. So in the perturbative approach that you talked about, are you working in 2+1 dimensions, or are you thinking of it as a 4-dimensional perturbative approach, perturbative theory?
No, we are working in 2+1 dimensions.
Okay, in both approaches. So in both approaches, you're working in 2+1 dimensions. Now in the non-perturbative quantization, there was a single scalar field, phi, and all the metric coefficients were determined by phi. You did not have explicit formula for that in the transparencies, but this is true. Now, what is it that we're quantizing in the perturbative approach? Which fields are we quantizing? You have got all these bar fields, right? N bar, psi bar, on the transparency 10, for example. N bar, psi bar, and gamma bar, and rho bar. So you must have done some gauge fixing, right? And for the gauge fixing that you talk about, it's probably like something like the Dondra gauge in the 2+1 dimensional gravity. Is that the only condition you use, or what all gauge fixing do you use, and then what are the degrees of freedom that are left?
Okay, so there are several things here. The first is, of course, when you find a reduced Hamiltonian, it is, even in terms of the new field, it is written in terms of one single scalar, okay? So the situation is very much the same as before. All the degrees of freedom are contained in the single scalar field, okay? Which has some, I mean, can be written in terms of the of this phi g field that I was referring to when I was talking about the usual non-perturbative quantization of the system. So that is one point. Another point is related with gauge fixing. Now, the gauge fixing that we are using when we are comparing both quantization is just the translation of the usual gauge fixing, namely small r equal to capital R and p gamma equal to zero, the momentum canonically conjugate to gamma equal to zero. Of course, you have to rewrite that in terms of the new fields and the canonical momenta, and you get an admissible condition, okay? And it is, what it is interesting about this model is that there is a sense that it is explained in the paper in which if you introduce a usual Dondra gauge in the system, you can prove that at the end of the day, the first approximation to this Dondra gauge is precisely this p gamma equal to zero and small r equal to capital R gauge fixing. So there is a sense in which one could think of the gauge fixing of the system as coming from the usual Dondra gauge in the four-dimensional formulation. Okay, does that answer your question?
Right. So, and the Dondra gauge that you wrote down is just HV nu equal to zero. You mean the covariant derivative with respect to the background metric of H bar mu nu equal to zero. Is that right?
And that's right. There is a typo there, and I will send the. There are two or three typos. I will send the corrected file to Jorge once I finish the talk. Yes, that is just the usual, the Bollinger Gauge with the derivatives there. Okay.
And then the final result. So you are looking at the perturbative vacuum and expanding out in terms of the non-perturbative vacuum and the non-perturbative Fock space, so to say. And so the statement is that there is such an formal expansion, but the resulting state is not normalizable in the non-perturbative state, in the non-perturbative Fock space. Is that the result?
Or is yes, there is.
So there is formally only led to an expansion, but that is not, the perturbative vacuum is in fact formally can be written as a state in the non-perturbative framework. But mathematically, it is not a state in non-perturbative framework because it is not normalizable in the non-perturbative Hilbert space. So that is a statement, right?
Yes, that is precisely the statement. Yes.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? So if not, I will continue. Now, let's move to slide number 15. Now, we'll discuss here the second meaning that I was referring to above. Now, here I will mostly talking about something that we also did with Guillermo and Eduardo and publishing this journal of mathematical physics. Now, endpoint functions, that is, vacuum expectation values of products of field operators at different space-time points, are the objects in terms of which the X matrix is written in traditional approaches to quantum field theory. Think of the LSZ formalism, reduction formulas, and so on. Now, in this example, if we now go back to the usual non-perturbative Fock space quantization of Einstein-Rosen waves, what we see is that we have the exact quantum evolution operator. And then we can get the Heisenberg picture evolution of the field operators in closed form and write down these end functions exactly. So for example, if we consider the two-point function, that is the vacuum expectation value of the product of the scalar that encodes the gravitational degrees of freedom computed in two different points, I mean labeled by this radial coordinate and time, you can write it down quite quickly, and you get this integral expression that we see here, in which there are two J functions computed in for different values of this capital R, and then there is an exponential term that involves this function E, which is in fact the function that relates the physical Hamiltonian and the non-perturbative Hamiltonian. Okay, and has that dependence in the constant G. Okay, so if you go to the next slide, the first thing that can be said about this integral is that it is convergent. It is conditionally convergent, but it is convergent. Of course, if we introduce some, if we regularize the fields, for example, by introducing a momentum cutoff, this cutoff would appear here as an upper limit in the integral. And of course, the fact that the integral is convergent means that you can take that limit and it will, well, this cutoff goes to infinity and this limit will be well defined. Now, endpoint functions can be obtained in a similar way, and they all seem to be finite. Certainly, four-point functions are finite. And then the problem is that because these are the integral in the expressions is oscillating. Like continue to find out if they are convergent or not. But they all seem to be fine. Okay. Now, in usual perturbation schemes, and think for example of standard QED, one makes the ansatz that the endpoint functions can be expanded as a power series in the coupling constants, for example, alpha for QV. And this is something that you really do right from the beginning. I mean, without thinking too much about it, you just say, well, we have an interacting theory in the usual, say, QED. You have some propagator, you have some vertices, and you have a way to expand endpoint functions as power series in the coupling constant, in the relevant coupling constant. The coefficients of these expansions are obtained through the computation of Feynman diagrams. So once you have, you know, your vertices, your propagators, you can compute, in principle, to an arbitrary order in powers of the coupling constant, these endpoint functions. Okay. Now, here we are in an interesting situation because we have an exact closed expansion for example, the two-point function or endpoint functions in general. So one can ask the following question: can we obtain such a power series expansion in terms of G for the previous two-point function? So what one would do to do that is say, well, let us expand the term involving the G, which was the double exponential term that appeared in the integrand in the previous transparency. That you can do, and you get that exponential involving T2, T1, and K, and some polynomials, these Pn plus 1 of K and T, which are polynomials in K and in this capital T, which is just a shorthand for the difference of times, okay? These polynomials are of the Dn plus 1 in K. Now, next slide, please. What you see is that if you exchange formally the integral and the sum, you will end up, and you just collect the, you look at the coefficients of powers of G, what you find is that you get some integrals that involve these two Bessel functions and powers of K. Now, those integrals are very badly behaved. I mean, you have an oscillating integrand, and also the amplitude of this oscillation is growing as a power of K. So it's really very difficult to make sense of those. Of course, one could introduce a cutoff to make them finite, and in fact that can be done, and we discussed that in the paper, and even find conditions that would guarantee uniform convergence that ultimately would allow this interchanging of the sum and the integral. Okay? But there are some problems with these conditions. They are, on one hand, rather restrictive in the sense that these integrals are defined for R1, R2, T1, and T2, and these conditions that you get are not valid for every value of these R's and these T's. And also, it's very unlikely that they will be universally valid for arbitrary endpoint functions, which means that if I then go to the four-point function, six-point function, and try to find what conditions would guarantee uniform convergence, then you don't expect that they will be the same ones, okay?
What are these conditions on?
These conditions involve G, involve the lambda, and R and T. Okay, they involve all the variables. I can tell you the form. I think I have it here. No, I don't have it here. I mean, it's a function of G, the R's, the T's, and lambda. Okay, and it's a nonlinear function. Okay. So I can try to find, I mean, maybe someone can find the paper and I will tell you later, okay?
Okay.
So there is something interesting to notice, and this is the fact that G can be seen both as a fixed length scale or as a coupling constant, okay? And this, in fact, leads to two possible points of view. These points of view are written here. One can either think of a weak coupling limit, okay, or look at the system at typical distances which are much larger than G, okay? Now, there are several possible attitudes to try to understand what happens with these expansions that I'm talking about here. The first one is try to keep the cutoff and try to find a way to remove it by absorbing it in a normalized coupling constant G, just following the usual approach that you use in perturbative quantum field theory to normalize when you have a, when you have an interacting theory such as lambda, phi to the 4, or QED. There is another attitude which you may take, which is the following. As you have an exact closed expression for these endpoint functions, you can try to find some ad hoc method to study the limiting behavior for small values of G, or, as I said before, equivalently for large values of R2, R1, T1, and T2. And, of course, that that is an asymptotic analysis of these intervals, and that is the thing that we did, because that will, in fact, that gives you a lot of information. And, for example, that gives you an approximation scheme to extract information from these complicated intervals. Okay? So we'll discuss that in the next slide. Now, I will be looking here at asymptotic expansions of two-point functions. I will skip all the technical details. It must be said that it is not easy to find the asymptotic behavior of these objects. Basically, all the standard methods that fail. I mean, if you try steepest descent, saddle point, Mellin transforms, they all fail. It's really a pain, and it's difficult to find the asymptotic behavior in any of the parameters that appear in the intervals. Okay, so even if you consider something like T2 minus T1 going to infinity, it's difficult to find the asymptotic behavior in that. Well, okay, at the end of the day, it can be done, and you can see the details in these papers that I was mentioning before. And the result is rather complicated. Just as an example, I am giving here the asymptotic value of the imaginary part of the two-point function in this region, defined by this condition here involving R2, R1, T2, and T1. And in the limit g equal to 0. Of course, we have expressions for these asymptotic expansions which are valid for all the values of R1, R2, T1, R2, with exception of a zero measure set. Okay, so basically you know how to do this for every value of the relevant space-time coordinates. Okay, now, for example, in this region, this is what you get. You find two terms. You find the first term, which is independent of G, and it is this. It involves a complete elliptic interval of the first time, and it's interesting to point out that this term corresponds exactly to the one that you would find for the two-point function if instead of using the physical Hamiltonian, which is this E function that I introduced in slide number 13, you use just the free Hamiltonian, okay? If you compute the two-point function for the free Hamiltonian, what you get is exactly this first term. Of course, in that case, I'm dividing these integrals by this factor of 40, okay? Now, there is a first correction in terms of G that is given by this second term that we see there. Now, this second term is complicated. I mean, it's something that you don't get just by turning at the interval. And the most important feature of this second term is how the functional dependent in G appears. There is a prefactor that involves a square root of G. Well, that's non-analytic, but you could claim that, well, you might have an analytic expansion in the square root of G. But then you see that there is a 1 over G in the exponent, in one of the exponents. I have highlighted these two terms in orange color, okay? So what you see is that there is a first correction, which is independent of G, but then there is a first asymptotic correction, which is non-analytic. It is intrinsically non-analytic, okay? You could get extra terms if you went to higher orders. We don't know much about the form of those extra terms. But it is quite clear that the limiting behavior when G goes to zero is given by a non-analytic expression. Now, in case you don't believe that the real behavior is given by that, you should go to the next slide But I'm giving you some hard evidence that, in fact, this approximation is quite good. Now, this plot means the following. I am fixing the values of R2 and R1 and defining this rho as a quotient of both, and this plot refers to this value of rho equal to 1.5. Tau here is just a different way. I mean, it's just T2 minus T1 over 4G. And I have taken the value for G, which is small, 0.02. Now, there are three plots here. There is a solid plot, which is the exact result of a numerical computation of the interval that defines the two-point function. That is the solid line. You see that it starts from zero, it grows, it has some oscillations, and then it goes down and it starts oscillating in a rather complicated way. It's quite unpredictable at the beginning, but then it becomes more predictable. Okay. Now, this free, what I refer here to as free, is just the first term, which is, as I said before, what you would find if you use, instead of the physical Hamiltonian, just the free Hamiltonian, the auxiliary free Hamiltonian. As you see, it is zero from, I mean, it starts being zero, then it suddenly jumps at the value of tau equal to 1, then it goes up, there is a similarity that corresponds to 2.5, and then it goes down quite smoothly. And now I am plotting the asymptotic behavior in all the regions. I mean, the expression that I gave in the previous slide referred to this special region in this parameter space. I mean, absolute value of R2 minus R1 smaller than T2 minus T1 smaller than the absolute value of R2 plus R1. In this plot that we are seeing here, that corresponds to values of tau between 1 and 2.5, okay? There are other expansions which are valid for just for the rest of the values in the parameter space, and in particular there is another one which is more complicated that is valid for values of tau beyond 2.5. And what you see is that with the exception of some singularities that correspond precisely with the singularities, discontinuities of the free part, what you get with this asymptotic expansion describes very well the exact value that you will get from a numerical computation. So this approach of just trying to find what the asymptotic behavior of the integral is quite effective in capturing the behavior of these two-point functions. Okay? Now, I have some comments about this in the next slide. The first one is that if you make an a priori choice of perturbative behavior, I mean, you choose to tailor expanding powers of G, then you cannot capture the physics of the system. Okay, and once you see that the behavior in G is non-analytic, it's clear that there is no way that you would have found that by just doing this tailor expansion. So the theory is perfectly well defined. You can, in fact, extract physical information with some approximation scheme rather efficiently, but it seems to be intrinsically non-perturbative, okay? It is not clear how the renormalization scheme that I was suggesting that one could use in principle would work here, because the final result is not a power series, okay? So it is very difficult to understand how you would get this result by a renormalization scheme, okay? Also, a renormalization scheme would end up giving a coupling constant, G, that would depend on the momentum, K, and some arbitrary scale that must be introduced in the renormalization process. Now, having in mind that G has a meaning as a characteristic length scale of the model, it is difficult to understand how it could be momentum dependent. Okay? Now, the model is, in a very clear sense, finite. I get finite expressions for the endpoint functions. There are quantum field theories, which are called finite. For example, when you have extended supersymmetry, even strings would have that feature. And in that case, finite means that you have finite coefficients for each power of the coupling constant that appears in the expansions for the Green's functions. Okay? And in particular, that also means that the beta function is zero and there are no running coupling constants. Now here, and this is my last slide, next one. This is probably not true because in our case, we're not choosing to expand in integer powers of G. So even though everything is finite, it is not clear, at least to me, that we can say that the theory is finite in the usual quantum field theory sense or normalizable in the usual quantum field theoretic sense. And, for example, I don't know if you can still say that the beta function is zero and there are no running coupling constants. I mean, probably those kind of statements just don't make sense in for this model. So, to conclude, I believe that the model is, in fact, neither normalizable nor finite in the usual sense, even though it's perfectly well defined, and you can, in fact, devise a procedure to extract physical information in a rather efficient way. So I conclude with this last statement that I am highlighting here. In my opinion, this may, in fact, be the case for full quantum gravity. So this is all I wanted to say. Now, if there are questions or comments.
Hi, this is Kirill from Perimeter. I have a question. Is this model in some sense unitary? Is there unitarity in here?
Well, yes. I mean, we have a unitary evolution operator, which is this one that I gave in slide number 5. I mean, you have, once you know the Hamiltonian, you even if it is this nonlinear complicated function of a free Hamiltonian, you can just build the unitary evolution operator as you would do in ordinary quantum mechanics. And this operator, this Hamiltonian operator, is a perfectly well-defined self-adjoint operator. So the exponential, this exponential of I times T2 minus T1 over 4G, and then the Hamiltonian, should be perfectly defined. So the answer is yes, we have a unitary evolution perfectly well-defined here. There is no problem with that.
But there is another sense of unitarity in quantum field theory. The cache rules, are they satisfied in this model?
Can you say that again? I didn't hear you very well.
There is another sense of unitarity. The standard sense of unitarity in quantum field theory is that cache rules for S matrix are satisfied. Is this true for this model?
Well, I mean, the usual, in my opinion, the sense of unitarity is this one, the quantum mechanical one. I mean, of course, if you don't have a Hamiltonian, then, for example, the thing that happens with the S matrix is that usually you don't know how to write from an experimental point of view, certainly it makes sense to look just at some limit of this unitary evolution operator, and that is this, what I call particle physics point of view X matrix. That is one thing. But, unitarity means that you have unitary evolution, that you have conservation of probabilities, and if you have a Hamiltonian for the system, the evolution operator is obtained just from the Hamiltonian. I mean, I would say that the meaning of unitarity in quantum field theory is just that, is the unitarity in quantum mechanics.
By this argument, you can show that any quantum field theory is unitary, because any quantum field theory has a Hamiltonian formulation, so there is a unitary evolution operator in any quantum field theory. But we know this is a very non-trivial requirement. Not any quantum field theory is unitary.
No. I think the statement is that either the Hamiltonian operator is typically not well-defined. It may formally look symmetric, but it may not be self-adjoint. Or it may be unbounded below. In this case, the Hamiltonian is both self-adjoint and is in fact completely bounded. So some rule that you would derive in ordinary following the procedure of ordinary quantum field theory, you can derive in this model. There will be no problem at all. I mean, the sum rule is a statement of conservation of probability, and this is actually conserved. But notice that, again, on the transparency phi, this Hamiltonian has its exponential factor, so it's not polynomial in the coupling constant. Or if you like, you'll get an infinite series, rather, in the coupling constant. The leading term is just H naught, the standard Hamiltonian of a free field theory. But then you get all these corrective terms all over. And the corrective terms are such that order by order, they look unbounded. But still, the total Hamiltonian is really bounded. There's no problem at all. One can just look at the total Hamiltonian as an operator and show explicitly that it is a bounded operator.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that.
So, did you want to make some comments about the relation with Max Niedermeyer's work and so on, and renormalizing group flows?
Okay, I can make some comments about that. Okay, on one hand, I would like to say that this is a simpler version of Niedermeyer's. I mean, what Niedermeyer tries to do is to study the quantization of the two polarization model to see what kind of conclusions he can draw from that. So you can also try to extract conclusions by using this model, and that is what I have tried to do here. Now, there are some. I have some questions about Niedermeyer's approach in the following sense. Here, one of the features of this model is the fact that you have a Hamiltonian which is a function of another Hamiltonian. Now, for Einstein-Rosen waves, this auxiliary Hamiltonian is just a free field theory. Now, if you consider the two polarization case, the auxiliary Hamiltonian is not a free field theory, but it's a sigma model Hamiltonian. Okay? So the first thing that you have to do is to consider the quantization of these sigma model Hamiltonian. But having in mind that the physical dynamics is given by this nonlinear function of the free field Hamiltonian. Now, my understanding is that what Niedermeyer does is just consider the free field Hamiltonian because he does not include any surface terms in his computations, in his approach. Now, if you prove that the Hamiltonian, that this sigma model Hamiltonian defines, is good, that you have unitary evolution, that the theory makes sense quantum mechanically, then because it is time independent, you can argue that, well, the nonlinear Hamiltonian would make sense and you would actually get a unitary evolution operator much in the same way as you get it here. But what he is finding is that the theory is non-normalizable. So even if he can draw some conclusions about this auxiliary Hamiltonian, I don't know if they go through all the way when you consider the full non-physical Hamiltonian. So I really don't know how to make that connection. And from that point of view, I'm not completely sure about what the results mean. Because basically what he says is, well, it is not normalizable. You have this auxiliary model is not normalizable. But then there is a way in which you can make sense of the thing. Instead of using a running coupling constant, you introduce something like a running coupling function or something like that. And apparently that is compatible with having a nice behavior for the beta function. But again, that would be true for the auxiliary theory. And I don't know if that goes through for the full physical Hamiltonian. In fact, we also wrote a paper in which we tried to see if this non-normalizability, if we could get this in a simpler way, and in fact, we reproduce exactly Niedermeyer's results. I have problems with the conclusion because I don't know if they will be valid for the full Hamiltonian, and I really don't have much more to say about that. I mean, I know some. So go ahead.
Okay, so, the qualitative question one can ask is the following, right? That somehow here you find that there is an exact answer, the theory makes sense, but if you try to perturb in the traditional sense, this perturbation series has problems and doesn't seem to converge. But the quality to conclusion of Niedermayer and other people is that that is because one is trying to expand around the trivial Gaussian fixed point. And in fact, one should be expanding around some other fixed point. And then the theory may make sense. So if you forget about the details of what they're doing and just take this as a qualitative lesson, it might be worth seeing if in the simpler case of one polarization model, one can see that the exact result does admit some kind of a perturbation expansion around some non-trivial fixed point of the renormalization group flow. I mean, I'm just suggesting this as a general thing that one might look at.
Yes, I agree. In fact, I have been making these comments that in principle, once you have the expression, for example, say for the two-point functions, you can introduce a cutoff and then pretend that that is what you have obtained by some perturbative computation involving Feynman diagrams or something, and then try to follow the steps that you would follow in ordinary quantum field theory to see if there is a way to normalize and try to draw some conclusions about that. And in fact, we may look at that in the near future. But, I mean, I really don't believe that will work out in the end. I mean, it's very difficult to, once you know what the right answer is, and we know the answer, we know that this thing is still non-analytic in G, it's very difficult to reconcile that with the fact that you could eventually find a normalization scheme and so on. But it is really worth looking at that. I mean, it would be interesting to prove, for example, that it is non-normalizable. In that sense, just introducing the cutoff, looking at the intervals that you get, and try to see if you can absorb infinities by redefining the coupling constants and so on and so forth, the way you usually do in quantum field theory. I completely agree. And actually, we are starting to think about that in this moment.
Because there are some similarities, right? On page 15, you say somebody should switch off their microphone. On page 15, you say that the third bullet point says that notice that G can be seen both as a fixed length scale or as coupling constant. And this is really the usual thing that people in renormalization group flow say, that when it comes to gravity, G has these double roles, basically. One can use either the Planck units, which is like keeping G as a coupling constant, G as a fixed length scale, or one can use this, the other units adapted to the cutoff units, adapted to the renormalization group flow and so on. So it seems to me that there really is some similarity, and your asymptotic expansions seem to correspond to using the fixed length scale, that is to say, correspond to using the Planck units. Everything is being done in Planck units. And I guess what you're saying is that, well, this is what I wanted to understand. So it seems to me that qualitatively you're saying that if we look at kind of effects which are large compared to the Planck scale, then the Planck length in this case, then in fact the effects may be modeled by some effective theory, maybe perhaps by the perturbative theory. But on the small scale, close to the Planck length, this is not the case. So can we look at your graph, such as the one on page 17, and try to understand this graph about what is kind of the Planck scale feature in this graph? And if I coarse-grained on the Planck scale and only looked at lengths or times which are large compared to Planck length, then the perturbation theory might be a good approximation. Can one make any such comments on your correlation function calculations?
Okay. The Planck scale is giving you, I mean, it is a characteristic oscillation length in this plot, okay? So
okay.
If you decrease the G, you will get more oscillations, okay? So it is true that if you take G to zero, you will end up having just what I have labeled as free. So, in that sense, you recover some kind of, in fact, the result that corresponds to a massless, axially symmetric scalar field in a Mikoskian background. Okay, there are some funny things, because if you take one of these capital R's equal to zero, I don't have the plot here, but it is in the paper. What you see is that you have oscillations about an average value, which corresponds to the free one, but then if you take G to zero, the amplitude of this oscillation doesn't go to zero. It's the frequency. I mean, you get something that oscillates faster and faster, but it doesn't go to zero. I mean, the amplitude doesn't go to zero. So in average, you have something that resembles the free behavior, but if you look in detail, I mean, the amplitude doesn't go to zero. That is a slightly different behavior, and that somehow is telling you that the symmetry axis in this model is somehow different from the rest of the space-time. I mean, there are some funny quantum gravitational effects that really, I mean, don't dissipate there. If you look, for example, in this time direction, so.
But you may add to coarse grain, right? I mean, if you coarse grain on scales larger than Planck length, much larger than Planck length, then the symmetry axis will not be so sharp. And if things are oscillating, it may be that the coarse graining will actually average them out to zero. So even on your plot, it might be, I mean, it sort of seems to be clear from your plot that if I were to coarse grain and average out, then the averaged coarse grained answer will actually coincide or will be well approximated by the free field answer, the perturbative answer, so to say. But if I don't coarse grain, if I, as you're saying, for example, at the axis, and I look at what is happening, then the non-perturbative effects are very important. So this seems to me quite exciting from the point of view of what we all say about four-dimensional quantum gravity, the interest of coarse graining, etc.
I completely agree with that point of view. It is exactly right. If you coarse grain, then you just recover what I have called free, which corresponds just to the auxiliary dynamics. And if you just don't coarse grain, then you see all these details. That is exactly true.
Okay, I was wondering if Laura is around, if he has any comments from Perimeter, because he has been looking at the similar problem, but from a kind of a complementary or opposite point of view, in which he was integrating out the gravitational degrees of freedom and getting kind of an effective theory for the scalar field, which then had some elements of non-commutative geometry. Laurent, do you have any comments?
Sorry, Laurent is not around.
Okay. Anybody else, any comments?
Can I ask another question?
Please.
It's still related to unitarity. There is another sense of unitarity. One can look at exact green functions, exact endpoint functions in momentum space, and then look at the structure of singularities in the momentum space. And then you see what the physical states are looking at the poles, and then, well, it's important that the physical states are what you think they are for the cut rules. So have you tried looking at, say, two-point function in the momentum space and trying to understand what the singularities are?
No, we have not looked at that, but it should be quite straightforward because, here you have the complication, if you want, that you have a rotational symmetry, so it's the Fourier expansion is slightly different from the plane wave one. But I somehow suppose that, the only thing that you have to do is basically removing the Bessel functions and introducing maybe some powers of k. So basically, you can read off the result from that. I mean, we have not looked at that in detail, but it should be easy to do it. But again, unitarity. I mean, you can try to now translate everything you do in your ordinary perturbative quantum field theory for this theory once you, I mean, try to translate it, okay? But, for example, unitarity that you know from the beginning that it is there, I mean, because you know that the Hamiltonian is a self-adjoint operator and so on, whatever I said before. So it may be interesting, and in fact we may look at that soon, just to make a detailed comparison between the usual quantum field theoretic approach to Green's functions and the exact results that we have. So that, in that, I completely agree with you. But again, I insist, as far as unitarity is concerned, We know that the theory is unitary because the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint. We have the unitary evolution operator. So you may try to understand that from, I don't know, from looking at the Green's functions, but it is there. I mean, it's clearly, I mean, the connection, again, may be interesting, but unitarity is there.
Kirill, what would one look for?
Well, would it be interesting to take exact Green point, Green functions, determine what physical states are by looking at the poles, show that the Katz rules are satisfied by summing over the physical states, exact physical states of the theory, which are determined by, like in the usual analysis, in LSD reduction formula, they are determined as poles of endpoint functions.
Yeah, right. And you're right that they will be different because the Hamiltonian is bounded above that will and below, and therefore the physical states will be shifted, will be quite different.
Yeah, so it would be interesting to see what they are and how unitarity is realized in terms of them.
Good point, yeah. Anything else? Any other questions? Okay, if not, next week we're going to have Robert Ockel. It's the same time, the same phone number.